Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The COVID death toll in the United States surpassed the 190,000 mark yesterday. The death toll is now at 190,909. The death toll here in the U.S. is far higher per capita than the EU, Canada, Australia, and Japan, according to an analysis from Vox. In the U.S., there have been more than 6.3 million confirmed cases, with more than 256,000 cases confirmed in the last week alone. More than 500,000 children in the U.S. have been diagnosed with COVID, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the rate of new cases among kids continues to rise. The COVID crisis is disproportionately affecting Native, Black, and Latino communities. As cases continue to fall in California and Texas, they are rising in 26 states, including Alabama, North Carolina, and the Dakotas. We're now learning more about what the virus does to the brain, and so-called long haulers are sharing their stories. These are people who've had a variety of health issues for months. So joining us to talk about the latest and what we can expect in the coming months is Dr. Albert Koh, Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infection Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Koh's research centers on the health problems that have emerged as a consequence of rapid urbanization and social inequity. Dr. Koh and his team mobilized the public health research capacity at their site in Brazil to investigate the Zika outbreak. And Dr. Koh joins us from Connecticut. Hi, Dr. Koh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a true pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I just wonder, there's so much going on. There's so much now that we're learning. There's still things we don't know. But I just wonder, as someone who really focuses on this issue, how do you assess right now where we are in the United States?
Yeah, I think we're at a crossroads. And I think the major lesson that we really still continue to learn is about the importance of implementing evidence-based policy. I'll just give you an example. I'm here based at Yale University in Connecticut. I was co-chair of our governor's Reopen Connecticut Committee. We got hit hard, early in March, April. We learned a lot from that. And I think much of the United States learned a lot from that, it's important to not reopen, too quickly. It's important to use face masks, social distancing, and that the risk of resurgence is high. We're at a crossroads now is because, that story has played out, through the south of the United States to the west of the United States, now in the Midwest. And now we're to the situation where we have several pressure points. One is reopening schools, and the second is the upcoming winter season where people are staying more indoors and more at risk. So we're at this crossroads, and I think it's really now time for here in the United States that we kind of take the lessons learned and start implementing seriously.
And there are so many lessons learned when you look to other countries. I mean, reading about Vietnam is fascinating. And I cited that analysis from Vox. They say that the U.S. death toll is far higher per capita than the EU, Canada, Australia, and Japan. Dr. Koh, what really stands out for you when you look at how other countries have dealt with and are dealing with COVID?
Yeah, I think, the major message that, we've seen and learned is that, first of all, implementing, proactively social distancing, face mask is much more effective than implementing it reactively. So once you're in the middle of the epidemic where there's widespread community transmission, those measures are always best done before the curve rather than during or after at the height of the curve. The second thing is that the risk of resurgence is really quite high. If we look at some of the countries that have done a great job or a good job, thinking about Singapore, Taiwan, New Zealand, you can see that even in these countries, there's the risk of resurgence, and there has to be constant vigilance. And that's the calibrating of the social distancing as an intervention method, reopening schools, closing schools, in order to make sure that there's not widespread, we don't get into the top of the peak or with widespread community transmission.
And Dr. Koh, how do we get a handle on this at a time when, for example, in some states like South Dakota, the governor there says we can still have big events like the Sturgis motorcycle event of county fairs, and there's no need to wear masks. I mean, it's just so difficult to think about how do we get through this when some governors are still basically saying, don't worry about wearing masks. According to a new study, there could be possibly 260,000 COVID cases just tied to that Sturgis rally. This is according to researchers from San Diego State University.
Yeah, so I'm not aware exactly of the methodology used in that study. I have seen it in the news, but certainly we're worried about what we call these super spreading events, which can occur from several behavioral, biological, as well as environmental reasons. But getting back to, I think, your question about, how long does it have, do we need to take, or how many times do we have to go through this story to really learn, what I think we have, a really solid evidence base, and that's face masks, social distancing, proper disinfection, hand hygiene. I just go back to the story, our situation here in Connecticut. We learned that lesson hard, in March and April, and we, it's really, I think, the heroes of this story in the Connecticut, in the Northeast, are really the citizens who have learned that lesson of the importance of social distancing. As you know, decisions are made not only because of evidence, but because of political reasons and other considerations. I'm on many of us in the scientific community, and the medical doctors, healthcare professionals, we're kind of flabbergasted about how those lessons learned are being ignored.
Right. Well, I want to give out the phone number. If you have any questions for Dr. Koh about what we know now, what we still don't know, if you have had COVID or if a loved one has had COVID, we'd love to hear about your experience, because we are learning a lot more about people who have health effects for months, young people, I mean, all age ranges. So give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Koh, when it comes to the politics, I just don't even know what to say anymore. We've done so many shows based on frontline documentaries about how this administration was warned early on, and they just did nothing. And in some cases, Chinese counterparts tried to get in touch with Trump. It took 2 weeks for the HHH secretary to get to him. So, people are talking about what Bob Woodward discovered in February and March. I mean, we're not surprised, because we've been talking about this for months. So we don't have to go over that again. But I will ask you, given that there still is really no national plan, and you do work with New Jersey very closely, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, I think a couple things. And maybe I'll just go back to your first point. Of course, I can't speak to what were the discussions, at the federal level and at the White House at that time. I'm actually on part of the WHO research and development blueprint for emerging infections such as COVID. So, we got a heads up in the first week of January that something was going awry. And I think if we go all the way back those 8 months, I think one remembers that there was that one case in Thailand of a traveler, and this is when in Wuhan they were reporting maybe 12, 15 cases. That was kind of the first sign that something was going wrong. I would have expected that the president's advisors, who are steeped public health officials, I'm sure they would have given him advice about, the contagiousness, the infection fatality rate, the mortality morbidity, even in those early days of January, February. Going back now about, what would be a robust response, to this, now that we're in the middle of this, epidemic here in the United States, I think there are two things that we have to think about. Surely that there is the importance of good governance. As in the introduction, many of you heard that I had worked in Brazil for 25 years. Brazil has a really great public health system, dedicated officials, and many of that that capacity and the expertise there has been hampered and prevented and actually decimated because of poor governance. So governance is always important, whether it's local or whether it's national, as well as in the global sphere. The other point would be is that I think we also, and probably now is not necessarily the right time, but we do need to reflect on how we got here. This has been a process. We always prided ourselves in the United States that we had the best public health system and surveillance system, best public health officials, and in the world. There has been a slow erosion of the capacity of CDC over the last 20 years, starting in 2000 or starting with 9/11. And I think we have to reflect why countries like, Korea, Taiwan, New Zealand, Singapore, are mounting much more robust, responses compared to us, which has been very fragmented. So I think we're going to have to, do some serious reflection about, what we're not only the short term related in the last, with the current government, but also what we've been the long term. We haven't invested in public health. I mean, this is one of the major problems facing our country. It's the COVID epidemic is a symptom of this, the lack of investment in public health, both at the federal as well as the state level.
We're speaking today with Dr. Albert Ko, Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. And you can join us if you have any questions about COVID or a personal story to share, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet @yourcallradio. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm probably going to repeat what your guest has said already in a way, but I think these revelations by Woodward with regard to Trump just raise incredible questions about not only what's happened, and we've almost had 200,000 people died already, but as he indicated, and maybe in general terms, what's going to happen going forward now? I mean, what kind of action is Trump going to be taking? Going to start wearing a mask? Going to start telling people he can't go to rallies? I mean, we're not getting leadership at the top, and we've got a lot of people who are following this kind of thing. So this is the same kind of thing that happened in England with Boris Johnson, who was poo-pooing the initial problems that they had there. So I'm not very hopeful that this is going to work out positively for us, because now the predictions are that we could have between 400,000 and 600,000 people dying from the epidemic. So I agree with him about the leadership issue. I'm just hoping that's going to happen and that people like Biden are really going to start getting on this more and more.
Well, thank you, Greg. And to add to your comment, Dr. Ko, Trump is having rallies and people are not wearing masks or distancing at those rallies.
Yeah, I think, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm a kind of a broken record, but I think we've learned how this, over the last, 27 million cases and, close to 1 million deaths, or 900,000 deaths in the world. I think we know what drives this transmission. It's, happens in congregate settings when people are in gatherings. This is a disease that happens, this is an infection that occurs. That's one of the unique features is that it's super spreading. Where you have maybe 20% of the people contributing 80%. And so when you have these big gatherings, you can get these kind of super spreading events. We know that how it's transmitted, for the most part. And we know that face masks, are effective. That's certainly, just to make a quick comment on face masks, that's something that we learned really importantly here in the United States. in our hospital settings. We saw large hospital outbreaks in Wuhan, you know, where the at the epicenter of the outbreak. We saw them in Italy. We see them in many countries in Europe, including the United Kingdom. And some hospitals got hit hard here in the United States, but you know, many of the hospitals actually protected themselves. And they protected themselves by using face masks and personal protective, you know, equipment. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence for the, these are the meat and potatoes of our public health response. And, you know, and it really takes, you know, not only leadership, but it takes people, good communicators to you know, tell different segments of our society why that's important.
And to that point about masks, Dr. Koh, Steve just wrote in, I've read articles that wearing masks may lessen the severity of COVID infections. And he sent us an article from UCSF and Monica Gandhi, a doctor and infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco, is quoted by saying it's likely that face masks, by blocking even some of the virus-carrying droplets you inhale, can reduce your risk of falling seriously ill from COVID. She says the more virus you get into your body, the more sick you're likely to get. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so that's a really, you know, potentially important hypothesis. I actually know Monica Gandhi. She's a friend and knew her since medical school, and doing an extra, you know, important work at UCSF for the COVID response. Let me just say that I think the evidence for that, you know, that's an, it's important to get that idea out there, that there may be, by reducing the dose, or what we call the infecting inoculum dose, that you could actually, you know, prevent severe symptoms or severe outcomes, but you may potentially immunize people. I think at this point, this is still a hypothesis. We really need to get more evidence, and I think it's a good call for people to actually look into whether that idea or that hypothesis is true or not.
This piece points out that in countries where mask wearing was already commonplace, such as Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Thailand, and Singapore, rates of severe illness and death have remained comparatively low. Dr. Koh, what are your thoughts about mask wearing in the United States? Do you think this is going to become a lot more common here?
Yeah, so let me just say one quick thing before that. I think you know, the you know surely masks, you know, it's plausible that masks, you know, reduce the dose that you're infected and reduce the severe outcomes. But I think the data is pretty good that, you know, that masks also prevent infection and prevent you from getting infected in the first place. And that if you go to those countries where they have low rates or risk of severe disease or severe complications, those are also countries that were, you know, small proportions of the population have been infected in the first place. And that's because of a myriad of things, multiple things. There's no magic bullet for COVID. So it's face masks, but it's also the social distancing. And strong social distancing support. I think coming back to the United States, I think the same thing, you know, I would say is that this is not going to, at this point, we don't have a magic bullet. There's not going to be one intervention that's going to prevent COVID and that's going to be, you know, entirely infected. So it's going to take, and this is the importance of citizenship, but it's going to be important to employ face masks, and that is going to have to be, you know, the new normal if we really want to get ahead of the curve on this, as well as social distancing together. And this really calibrated, you know, opening of society, whether it's our schools, whether it's our workplace, and so forth.
Well, there's another really amazing stat in this UCSF article. They looked at two cruise ships, one docked outside of China, it was the first outbreak outside of China, and they looked at a cruise ship docked in Japan. Those people were wearing masks, and they found that 18% were asymptomatic. And then they looked in March, an Argentinian cruise ship. People there were not masks. 81% were asymptomatic. That's amazing, Dr. Koh. So when the people had on masks, only 18% were asymptomatic. The people who did not have masks, 81% were asymptomatic.
Yeah, so there's a lot, and this is going back to some of the epidemiological principles. So certainly that could be a potential explanation. But there's some caveats to that. One is that there are what we call confounders on these ships, and I think the one in Japan was the first big cruise ship outbreak, which was the Princess Diamond, and those people are also older, right? And one thing that we're still trying to get our heads around is that what are the things that influence the proportion of people who are infected but are asymptomatic versus infected and get symptoms, and then also get infected and get severe complications. And we, I think there's increasing evidence that age is important. What we call the infection to fatality ratio changes across age, so that the elderly are a much higher risk, up to 30 times higher risk than the youngest segments of our population. And so on these cruise ships, you also had different, age structures, right? I think the prior Princess Diamond, I may have gotten this wrong, but I believe the average age was almost 60 to 70 years of age. That was a very elderly population. So there could be other explanations that can cause that. At this point, we can't really discount, why is the asymptomatic to symptomatic rate different from one cruise ship to another? Is it, it could have been for several different reasons, including the environment the flow of air in these cruise ships. The one thing I would not mention is that what we do know is that probably half the people infected, on general, in average, are asymptomatic. And I think the second part of that is that people who, the one thing that we're learning about COVID is that some people get really mild symptoms. Sometimes they just feel under the weather. They just feel tired, and it can actually be for a short period of time. So that definition of what we call asymptomatic or oligosymptomatic, oligosymptomatic meaning few or very mild symptoms, makes it very difficult to figure out, whether someone's truly asymptomatic with the absence of symptoms or they have some mild symptoms. And if it's done differently or surveyed differently from one ship to another, so you're kind of comparing apples and oranges.
Well, thank you for that email and that really important article. Today, we are talking about COVID-19, what we know, what we don't know. Yesterday, sadly, we passed the 190,000 mark. The death toll is now at 190,909. In the U.S., there have been more than 6.3 million confirmed cases, with more than 256,000 cases confirmed in the last week alone. We now know that more than 500,000 children have been diagnosed, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the crisis is disproportionately affecting Native, Black, and Latino communities. After a short break, we're going to talk more about what's now being called long haulers. These are people whose sicknesses have persisted for months. And there are 7,000 people in a Facebook group sharing their experiences, and they are now working with scientists to share this very important information. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about COVID with Dr. Albert Koh, Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Koh's research centers on the health problems that have emerged as a consequence of rapid urbanization and social inequity. If you have a question for Dr. Koh about what we know, what we don't know about COVID, if you have a story to share, if you or someone you know has had COVID, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Dr. Koh, we have an email from John who says, He names a couple doctors who are talking about the epidemic of vitamin D deficiency. Over 40% of the population is clinically deficient in this cheap and plentiful supplement. He cites a clinical study out of Spain that found supplementing with vitamin D decreases chances of acute respiratory complications from 50% down to 2%. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of research, especially in children, about vitamin D supplementation and whether that can prevent or mitigate the effects of respiratory viruses. Not only children but adults, we get whether it's a common cold or influenza or respiratory syncytial virus, you get respiratory infections, and vitamin D is thought to play an important role in really maintaining the integrity of our respiratory epithelium, that's the tissues in our respiratory tract, as well as, to help the immune response. The trial results on those have been kind of a little bit all over the place. I think there is good, I think there is a consensus that vitamin D deficiency, can make people, have a higher risk for being infected and perhaps getting severe complications or moderate to severe complications, but it's not really been clear whether supplementing vitamin D, especially in the acute phase, like when someone's sick, is going to change their course. I think we need. I'm actually not aware of the study, from Spain, so I can't really comment on the rigor in the the validity of that study. But I would assume that we're going to need more information, specifically, whether it does play a role for COVID.
Well, thank you for the email, John. After the election, we're actually going to do some series on health because there's just so many different angles to take. So we'll definitely do more on vitamin D. Thank you so much for that. Dr. Koh, let's talk a little bit about what we now know about long haulers. If you just type in long hauler, it's getting a lot of attention at the local level. I was just watching a video from News 5 Cleveland. Isabel Power is only 22 years old. She used to work out 4 to 5 times a week. Now she says she struggles to brush her teeth and has fainted 3 times in the shower. The New York Times recently had a piece called "For Long Haulers, COVID-19 Takes a Toll on Mind as Well as Body." One person said, "It makes you depressed and anxious that it's never going to go away." So first off, what are your thoughts about what we're learning about these long haulers?
Yeah, I think, Rose, I think one of the things is for all of us, whether we're, clinicians as well as public health, professionals, each day we're learning something new and we're completely humbled by, what we don't know, but also what we thought we would know, thought we would know and didn't come out to be true. I think the clusters of this hyperinflammatory disease in children, it's called MISC, was something that was unexpected when, the signal of these cases came up in Europe, in the UK, and then New York City. So we are learning everything, something new each day. And I think one of the things that, I think was surprising, this is an acute infection, and to have the complications that are being described by the long hauler population are really something that, certainly worrisome. Let me say a couple things about that is that, there are a large range of from mild to severe symptoms. It's not clear what precipitates those. We have people with mild disease who will have these long hauler type symptoms. We have people with severe disease who've been hospitalized who will have these long hauler symptoms. I think one thing that we don't know it now, and studies are being taken to follow what we call cohorts or groups of people who've been infected to really drill down on this, but we don't really know how much or what proportion. A lot of the studies have been series of cases, and we don't know how representative they are of all of the, certainly the 29 million, people who've been infected, to date. Or 27 million people who've been infected, to date. So I think that's the big question for our future is that, these symptoms, appear real. They've been, reported in all the different continents, this makes us extremely concerned about these chronic sequelae or complications or symptoms that people feel with various degrees of severity. And we just need to get a better handle about what is the risk of people getting these chronic sequelae, what proportion of people, and then what are the risk factors, and what causes people to have these long prolonged presentations of COVID.
NPR spoke with a 34-year-old woman who said months after getting COVID, she's still experiencing shortness of breath, chest pains, vomiting, and neurological symptoms that range from headaches and fatigue to hallucinations and jumbled words. I mean, this just sounds horrific. Dr. Koh, is the U.S. government setting aside funding so epidemiologists and scientists can study what's happening here?
Well, so I'm probably not the best person to ask on that. I don't know exactly what research projects are being funded, or how much of the research is being done. I know it is certainly a priority for National Institutes of Health. Dr. Fauci has talked about this several times. It's certainly an important issue that needs to be drilled down on. And I think one of the big issues is this because are these symptoms caused by persistence of the virus that's kind of setting off and causing, tissue inflammation and destruction? Or is this a residual process? Is this like inflammation, like a souped-up inflammatory response that's caused by initial infection that's disappeared? And that's going to be important because that's going to key us in on how we're going to, get effective therapeutics, how we're going to be able to treat this better. And provide some insights on the mechanisms so that we can have really targeted therapies. But we need to understand what that mechanism is. Well, we need to understand what proportion of people get it, what are the risk factors for that, what the mechanism is, so that we can really come up with an effective and safe response to this condition.
Yeah, a number of doctors are quoted in the New York Times story. Natalie Lambert, a health researcher at Indiana University School of Medicine, surveyed 1,500 long-haul patients through the Facebook page, and she found that anxiety was the eighth most common long-haul symptom cited by 700 respondents. Difficulty concentrating was high on the list. 400 reported feeling sadness. And then when you look overseas, researchers from Italy published in JAMA found that about 9 in 10 hospitalized patients said they still had symptoms after about 2 months. And then the Washington Post had a piece about Bergamo, Italy, one of the first hotspots in the world. They brought back 750 patients, and about 30% say they still have lung scarring and breathing trouble.
Yeah, so again, this is, this sequela for an acute infection, this chronic sequela, are certainly concerning. It was kind of a little bit unexpected. We haven't really seen that play out. I mean, when we think of the cousins of the coronavirus, or the COVID-19 virus, we think of the original SARS virus, and that was a really severe disease. And people had chronic symptoms, but it could have been because of the original lesions or the original illness. We get infected by other members of that same family, the common cold virus. We get infected multiple times, and you can see. Today we really don't have evidence that this causes a high proportion of chronic illnesses. So this really takes us by surprise. A couple of things that, I think just some caveats about how we're going to think about this. And this goes back to the question about risk. So if you get COVID, how many people will go get these long haulers type symptoms, syndrome with chronic symptoms? And one of the problems when we're looking at studies at different parts of it, of the world, is that some of these people who participate in these studies, they may be selected, right? And so the proportions that we see may not be exactly what happens among a representative group of people who've been infected. That's one issue. The second is that, you know, there are a lot of there's also a lot of external issues or, you know, challenges that come up with somebody who's had COVID. You know, they've been quarantined, they've been isolated. They may also have suffered from, you know, the economic impact as well as the psychological impact of having an acute disease. And so trying to tease out all of those pieces require kind of carefully designed studies of representative populations of people who've been infected with COVID, and then as well what we call control groups, so that we can understand, okay, is this really above the expected for the baseline? Above that. But that said, I think, you know, as you for all the evidence that you you've just described, I mean, this is certainly real. This is something that we have to really focus more research and really understand the proportion of people infected, the risk, and also why this is happening. That we can identify how to respond to this and treat this effectively.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Albert Koh, Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. And if you have any questions or comments or stories to share about COVID, we'd love to hear from you. How are you really thinking about where we are right now at a time when COVID is rising in 26 states? As I said yesterday, we passed the 190,000 mark. The death toll is now at 190,909. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Koh, let's talk about college students. Many college students went back to school in the last couple of weeks. Two of your colleagues at the Yale School of Medicine started a Twitter page called the We Rate COVID Dashboard to evaluate how universities are handling their outbreaks. Since August 22nd, Indiana University identified 1,370 positive cases. More than 700 students at Florida State tested positive. What are your thoughts about what's happening at colleges and the outbreaks that we're seeing?
Yeah, so Rose, this question really, you know, kind of this question emphasizes, you know, a lot about what we kind of reinforces what we knew about and what we've known and experienced with COVID over the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 months. First of all, it's highly transmissible, highly contagious disease. Second of all, in congregate settings, you know, with the addition of super spreading, you can get these explosive outbreaks that happening. And so all those formulas come together, you know, when we have people coming back from colleges, who are coming from all over the country and perhaps other places in the world. And, you know, I think that one of the issues that come up is that we know that the other thing that's played out is that COVID travels by air, you know, by travel, COVID spreads by travel. And so when you have people who are, you know, infected with COVID from Texas or Florida coming to Connecticut, you know, in my state or in New York, those risks represent risks and introduction. I think some states have gotten it, some states and schools have gotten it right. And I think, you know, part of that is that, you know, understanding that COVID travels over distances or spreads over distances, you know, students who've returned, incoming students would be quarantined, tested in quarantine. Here at Yale, we test our students twice a week. So we're doing not only intake testing, but we're testing them aggressively so that, you know, we can still contain any introductions of transmission that occur. I think this, you know, the schools that have gotten themselves in trouble, you know, and I think many of them are in the South, you know, are schools where they've opened in the middle of their epidemic or towards, you know, or they haven't come down off the curve. And so you still have enough infected people, you know, in the population, and including students who are coming back, coming to schools. And then, you know, the second factor is the behavioral factor, you know, which is, You know, we know that uptake of use of face masks, you know, implementation of social distancing is much less, the uptake is much less in younger age groups. So that's, I think, you know, that's a real challenge, and it's a setup for outbreaks that we've witnessed. You know, USC has had an outbreak as well, University of Southern California, University of North Carolina. Many of these schools have had to shut down because of this, of these outbreaks.
Yeah, and this is concerning because a lot of young, overall healthy, active people have had long-term symptoms. A UCSF study from July found that 1 in 3 young adults may have severe symptoms from COVID.
Yeah, and you know, in this time, and again, as I mentioned, we're humbled every day about what we're learning about COVID. And in this time of uncertainty, and we know this is a disease that's much deadlier than seasonal flu. We know this is a disease that may have, you know, important long-term consequences. We are learning about, I think you mentioned about the chronic lung fibrosis, or, you know, the having scar tissue in the lung, or having cardiac complications. These are things that we don't know about. And so to be not, you know, I think to not follow through with what we do know works, such as evidence-based practices, such as face masks, social distancing, quarantine, isolation, testing, I think is really problematic when we're thinking about opening our schools.
Today, we are talking about COVID with Dr. Albert Koh, Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. And I apologize for the buzz that you're hearing on the line. We tried to connect with Dr. Koh over Skype, but for some reason, the technology just didn't work. And during COVID, unfortunately, we cannot have guests in studios. So sometimes we unfortunately have the buzz. So I'm really sorry about that. Dr. Koh, in a recent town hall you did in New Jersey, you talked about some of the concerns that you have about the cold winter months ahead. First off, what are your thoughts about what we're learning out of Europe? We're seeing cases go up in Spain, Germany, Italy, and the UK.
Yeah, so well, just one thing is that, so, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, but I'm in Connecticut, and have
oh, sorry, Connecticut.
No problem. Yeah. It's they're both great states, and So what are the pressure points on this? So one is the reopening of the schools. The second is, as we get colder, you know, and we're moving, for example, outdoor restaurants into indoors, and people are spending more time indoors. You know, we're concerned about all those, you know, that increases contact. We know social contacts, you know, what drives transmission, people being close to each other, drives transmission. And we can also see that if you relax the strong social distancing, as what happened in Europe, you're going to have a large resurgence. So as many of you know, Western Europe was hit very hard, you know, before our epidemics in the northeast of the United States. They were hit in February, March. You know, they did strong social distancing, and then they opened up very quickly over the summer, and people went vacationing and traveling throughout the different, you know, within countries and between countries. And then you've seen it, you know, the COVID come back with a vengeance. That's the scenario that we want to try to avoid here in the United States. And it's going to be also important because not only, you know, in the winter months, we're expecting, because of the increased time indoors and the potentially increased social contact, we're also going to go into flu season, influenza season. And many of our hospitals in the United States, and particularly in the Northeast, already go into surge crisis just because of influenza without COVID. So you can imagine if we have these two epidemics happening of seasonal influenza together with COVID, this is going to be a real pressure situation for our healthcare systems.
What are you hearing from your colleagues in the healthcare, who work in healthcare, about how they're preparing for the fall?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that I think is key and most important, and I think throughout the United States and in the world, is influenza immunizations. We need to immunize, you know, our populations so that, you know, if somebody, to decrease the proportion of people who have symptoms such as cough, sore throat, fever from influenza, so that you can better detect COVID. And that's going to be important, because you can imagine if you're sick because of influenza, you're going to have to be isolated until you're tested. And that's going to be loss of productivity, loss of work, you know, work days, loss of school days. So in the second reason for, you know, the importance of influenza immunization, and universal influenza immunization, not only of, like in Connecticut, we have a state mandate for immunization of influenza for pre-K students. You know, we need universal immunization of all school children as well as adults. The second thing that we need to do is we're going to have to be in this kind of back and forth. And I think the example of Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea, and where they're loosening up, and when there's signals, you know, triggers of resurgence, they're closing back down. I think this is going to be our reality, you know, for the months to come, and certainly until we get better and more effective public health interventions, such as vaccine.
Well, Dr. Koh, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rose. It's a real pleasure, and thank you to your audience as well.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you. Dr. Albert Koh is Department Chair and Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the Yale School of Medicine. You can find out more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.